Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone, and this is Carl with the ISF podcast. Glad you could make it with us, and of course, as usual, my co-host Rachel is with us. Say hello, Rachel.
Hello, Rachel.
Of course, you always do that. I should say hello, Carl, and you'll say hello, Carl. But anyway.
I mean, you always set me up for it. How can I not?
Yeah, that's true. That's true. This is true. Anyway, we would like to welcome back one of our favorite guests, director, producer, writer, and all-about man about town, Ted Nicolau. Ted, nice to have you back.
Hey, thanks, Carl. Hey, Rachel.
I just have to
nice
say,
to
our favorite guest, that remains to be seen. No offense, Ted, but I think that we'll figure it out soon enough. You might be pretty awesome. I mean, if you're the guy that directed.
It's okay.
You know.
If I'm second or third, I'll live. Don't worry.
You think you can handle that? Okay, well.
Yeah.
So Ted, you have a couple of new things happening, and that's one of the reasons we have you on the show. So tell us what's going on.
Well, I just finished last week, in fact, or a week and a half ago, a two-part kind of short horror movie for Full Moon Features called Don't Let Her In. And so that's you can find that streaming right now, both episodes. And we sort of set a start date for Subspecies number 5 coming up in sometime probably October to start shooting.
Nice. So tell us more about this two-parter. Where can we see it and give us a little info on it and such?
Yeah, Don't Let Her In. It's part of Charlie's new streaming offerings that are he's decided to try releasing like a half-hour episodes once a week of a series of movies, and so far they've done Gingerweed Man, and they've done a movie called Miskatonic University, The Resonator that Billy Butler directed that sort of picks up from, you know, Stuart Gordon's From Beyond. And basically they're like little kind of short stories, horror short stories that are designed to be told in episodic fashion. Don't Let Her In is my kind of version of a demonic possession story about this young couple, Amber and Ben, that are artists and musicians that live in a big old spooky loft in downtown Los Angeles in the Arts District. And in order to make their rent, they open the door to a new roommate, this kind of strange, sensual artist named Serena, who kind of slowly takes over their lives in a very strange and frightening way. And I won't say too much more about the story, but suffice it to say it's sort of based on the idea of a roommate from hell. That turns out to really be a roommate from hell. And
okay.
You can find it on the Full Moon Features app, on Full Moon Features. And now it's also streaming on Amazon Prime and Roku and Amazon Fire TV, Google Play, and Xbox One, all the FullMoonFeatures.com streaming platforms.
Nice. Nice. So what can you tell us as far as, you know, the resurgence of Full Moon? How did that happen?
You know, Charlie has always been around and making movies and various you know, rises and falls of his company and various levels of budget from the early days when the budgets were, you know, more in the neighborhood of $1 million and up. To today when the budgets are very, very low, but the ambitions of the people that are working for him are very high. And for Don't Let Her In, it was a very short 6-day shooting schedule and kind of a one location story designed that way by me and the writing of it, one location and a very small cast of three leads, in an attempt to kind of push myself to see if I could tell a story very simply and very economically and still kind of bring the production value that I like to bring to it.
We're actually
now did you write this also?
Yeah, I wrote
it. Oh, go
ahead,
Rachel. Yeah.
What did you say, Rachel?
Well, I was just saying I'm noticing kind of a trend right now with all the directors we've been talking to recently. Everybody seems to be going for that more like minimalistic, can we shoot it in one location? Can I do it with people not actually having to be close to each other? So, like, seriously. And I think that, honestly, COVID is maybe bringing rise to a lesser used form of filmmaking, which is that really minimal style of as few actors as possible. Let's bring our production costs down as much as possible so that we can make it look as good as we want. But can we also do this safely for people? And I'm not going to lie. I have enjoyed a lot of the movies that I have seen recently that have been specifically like pandemically filmed. And I think it's fantastic.
Yeah. I mean, there's two issues at work. One is the, budgets are just harder to come by these days, and money for independent films, and there's like more and more filmmakers, that are actually working in the craft these days. So as budgets get tighter, you try to find ways to economize, and one single location is one of the greatest ways to keep the costs down. And then the second factor at work is the pandemic, which brings about like the need to keep the crew small, to keep the cast small, to kind of observe the safety measures that are required of a production to be able to shoot safely. And so all of those things kind of add up to, wow, you're just you're working in a different world than you used to be working in.
Do you find it easier to do something like this, or do you wish for the days back when you had a bigger budget and bigger crew behind you?
Oh, always bigger budget, bigger crew, more shooting days, more technical toys to play with, more support from the crew. It is definitely, it's an easier way to make a movie, but there are benefits to having a very lean sort of a production crew too. There are certain crew positions that you have to have, and even on Don't Let Her In, we sort of did not have some of those crew positions that would have been really helpful to have. So the filmmaking suffers a little bit by the fact that there's just not every crew position is filled. But still, you get to make a movie, and it's a challenge, and it's kind of a joy to make films. So you do what you have to do to get a film made.
Nice. I got to give credit to everyone we've talked to, yourself, including people like Joel Weinkoop and Mark Pirro and such, where you're adaptable to the situation, because nobody knew a year and a half ago that we were going to go through this with COVID.
Yeah.
And of course, and it's also changed. I think in many ways it will change production of films, how people look at films, and certainly, in terms of streaming and things like that. It's a good thing you've got the distribution of Full Moon behind you in the streaming, because that's one of the hardest things to do.
Yeah, to get distribution is you can make a movie, but if you can't get it out in the world, it's kind of sad. With Full Moon, there's a kind of a built-in audience and a publicity machine, and hopefully, you know, the audience will grow depending on the quality of the film. So yeah, I mean, I'm lucky that I've had, you know, I've had an opportunity to work on Full Moon films, you know, for a lot of years, and the pandemic sort of knocked everybody down and kind of locked everybody in their house. But as things are starting to open up, you know, the movie making is coming more fast and furious.
Yeah, now with the Full Moon streaming service and such, is some of your older material available also, and other films out there that they produced?
Yeah, on the Full Moon Features app, that, you know, kind of opens the door to kind of everything that Charlie has produced over the years, almost everything. There are a few films that he doesn't have the rights to anymore. They've lost the rights and various legal complications. But yeah, Full Moon Feature is $6.99 a month, or, you know, $50 a year, something like that. Opens the door to hundreds and hundreds of films, and most of my old films, except for Terrorvision and Dragon World, a few that, you know, belong to other people now. But yeah, you can see Stuart Gordon films.
I will tell,
you know, just,
yeah.
What'd you say, Rachel?
Oh, no, you can keep going.
Oh, no, I'm done.
Well, I was just going to say that, sorry about that, buddy. I was just going to say that for everybody out there looking to watch, like, one of the wildest, weirdest horror movies from the 80s I've ever seen in my life, you can find Terrorvision, directed by this effusive Todd Nicolau we're interviewing right now. It's absolutely free on YouTube, and it's a full, uninterrupted, ad-free playthrough.
Wow,
and
cool. Yeah, because it's
surprisingly good quality.
Wow, that's good. Yeah, because that movie's been off and on very, very hard to see, which sort of added to its kind of infamy over the years, you know, as people turn their friends on to it, first through VHS.
Bit of
VHS,
a cult status.
Then,
I can see why.
Yeah.
I mean, if you look at that film, you got two of the greatest cult actors, well, three, but two of the greatest, which would be, of course, Garrett Graham and Mary Warnoff. You know, they're gods and goddesses, both of them. And then, of course, Burt Remsen.
Yeah, Burt Remsen, Diane Franklin, another, you know, actress who's been around forever.
Was she the one that played
that,
Sheila?
She's the one who plays the, she was in, what was that? Played like a French exchange student in a movie back in the, she was also in the
I remember that movie with Laurence Olivier, I think.
Huh? I don't know about that, man.
Maybe I'm thinking Diane Lane.
Are we thinking
the John Cusack movie, Better Off Dead? Or
yeah, Better Off Dead. Yeah. She was in Better Off Dead.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
That's one of my favorite movies. I knew it. Oh, my God.
Yeah, she was super cute back in the day when those movies were made. And Terrorvision, you know what? We got really lucky on the cast with Terrorvision, and the cast brought so much to the film, you know, and took the script and just elevated it into something completely crazy. You know, that plus the Italian studio where we shot it, and all the Italian artisans that worked on the film just really kind of elevated the film to something beyond what I could have even imagined, you know, writing the script.
My God, was that house not fucking crazy?
Yeah. That was Giovanni Natalucci was the production designer on the film. He came to Los Angeles for a week or so when we were in pre-production, and we kind of went through location folders of photographs of like houses from the valley and swinger houses and porn locations, and it just sort of filled his brain with a lot of incredible imagery. And then he went back home and designed that house. It's just like the ultimate pleasure palace, ludicrous pleasure palace.
Yeah. So did it's actually the Pleasure Den. It's where they spend most of their time, but whatever. So I just have to ask this, and Carl knows where I'm going with this. Holy crap. How? Like, explain to me the whole story behind, if you guys have never seen this movie, literally every wall in this house is decorated. If it's got a painting on it, it's a painting of some sort of abstract nude woman in very 80s colors. Was that all made for the movie? Was the house already, it was made for the movie?
The house
Holy shit, that is perfect.
The house was built on a soundstage by an Italian crew. The paintings were painted by Giovanni Natalucci's team to kind of reflect the kinks of Garrett Graham and Mary Warrenoff. It's an amazing set. And the kid who plays Sherman in the film, his parents were kind of Christians. And they asked me to please not photograph him against the background of those paintings, but it was kind of an impossible task, you know. So that the film is just, it's crazy. I thought I was making kind of a movie that kids would be haunted by for, you know, if they saw it on television. But it turned out to be almost beyond what kids were able to see, but somehow kids did see it. And I think it did kind of haunt them because it's so much like nothing you've ever seen before.
It is so
fucked up. Well,
I mean,
that was definitely
like, grandparents, parents are dead, and they take time to like stop and feed this giant monster snacks and play it music and teach it to speak. And then they're like, oh yeah, you killed my parents. What the fuck?
Well, they don't know that their parents are dead, actually. They think their parents are swinging in the bedroom for part of that time, you know? Until he kills one of the kids. It's not quite real to them. Plus, it's, you know, an opportunity to make big money. So, you know, who cares? They don't like their parents all that much anyway.
Right.
You know, so moving along from that, another series that you're very, very connected with and most people would know is the Subspecies series. So tell us about that and filming in Budapest.
It was actually Romania, in Bucharest.
Romania. I'm sorry.
Well, about the time of Subspecies, Charlie was approached by a Romanian expatriate who had left Romania, settled in the United States, and after the revolution in 1989, where they kind of the downfall of the dictator and communism, he wanted to go back to Romania and start doing business. So he came to Charlie and kind of proposed a deal where the Romanian film industry would pay for the Romanian costs and Charlie would pay for the American costs and we would make this movie. So basically, Charlie sent me over there for a week just to scout locations and meet the people to see if I thought it was even possible to do. And when I got over there, you know, Romania was such a desolate place at that time, you know, right after the fall of communism, there was like everything was gray. You couldn't find anything in the stores. The restaurants were all really crappy. The waiters and waitresses hated you. But what was amazing was the theater was really vital, and the actors, you know, sort of had a subculture of their own that was just an amazing, funny, wild, drunken kind of culture. And I was introduced to that through by Vlad Palmescu, who was going to be the director of photography on the film, and his girlfriend at the time, now his wife, Juana, who was going to be the costume designer. So they kind of took me all over the place. We traveled around the country and saw castles and churches and all these amazing locations in Transylvania that we would be able to shoot. And, you know, the thought of shooting a vampire movie in Transylvania, first American co-production in Romania after the revolution, was like too much of a temptation for me to pass up. And so I came back to Charlie and said, yeah, it's going to be very difficult to shoot there, but I want to do it. And so then a couple of months later, I went back and we started shooting, and it was difficult. It was horrible. I kept a journal on the first film just to keep my sanity because, you know, the actors were revolting all the time, the American actors. The crew was revolting all the time because they weren't getting paid. We sometimes didn't have enough film to shoot the next day's material. The weather was changing and it was turning. We were supposed to be there for, you know, 4 weeks and ended up being there for a few months. So it was turning into winter and we were up in the mountains and there was nothing to eat and wine was cheap. And it was really, really a challenging situation. But, you know, through the help of Vlad Palnescu and Juana, who kind of helped me get through it and kind of helped, you know, manage the crew when the producer who, you know, initially brought us there kind of started locking himself in his hotel room because things were just too hairy. We got through it and finished the film, and Paramount liked it enough to request a sequel. And so then I went back another couple of years later and we did two of them back to back, you know, massive kind of 70-day shooting schedule. And that was challenging, but, you know, over the years, Romania kind of came out from under communism, and the young people, because birth control was kind of outlawed at the time, so there was this big bump of young people in the population. So in a way, the 90s in Romania were kind of like the 60s in the States, where, you know, the creativity of youth kind of started showing its face. And so it's, you know, remained a country really divided by, you know, bitter poverty and towns and villages that were still, you know, in the early 20th century. But it was an amazing place to work, and the actors there are incredible, and the craftspeople were incredible. So yeah, it was an adventure, but a true adventure.
You know, and that's a really good series too. I mean, you know, you can consider it low budget, but for what you did, I mean, it looks great. The scenery, everything, you use it really well, and your actors are really good too. I love your lead vampire. He's wonderful.
Yeah, he's an amazing actor. An amazing actor. Anders Hove is his name. He's Danish. And at the time we did the first one, he was on a soap opera called General Hospital, playing kind of one of their greatest villains. And he came along, and at the time of the first film, he was drinking a lot, and it was a crazy, crazy time. But we ended up really getting close, and on the second film I said, hey, I want you to do this film, but no drinking on the set. And then I'll come and we'll have a bottle of wine when they're taking the makeup off you. And he's become a really, really close friend, man with a big heart, and a really incredible actor. He really brought that character over the course of the three movies. You know, he brought so much humanity and kind of pathos to the character. It was brilliant.
Oh, yeah, I agree 100% on that.
I don't even know if I want to say this is low budget, because I am looking at some stills from these movies, and the makeup is amazing.
Yeah, like, the guys that did the makeup are, like, really, really great artists. You know, the first one was Greg Canham, designed the makeup. And then on numbers two and three, it was Wayne Toth and Norman Cabrera who work in makeup effects to this day. And they were an incredible team. And really, you know, when you've got an actor as volatile as Anders Hove, having to sit down for 2 or 3 hours of makeup every morning and then another hour to remove it, you need some uniquely funny and charming people to be applying that makeup, or else they're going to get, you know, like knocked down. So the makeup artists and the sculptors were incredible. Yeah.
Oh my God. If you ever see those guys in the future, please give them like a fist bump or a high five or whatever your preferred form of greeting is, because they are amazing. And I really feel like, especially with movies like this, these people don't get talked about enough. So I love it that you remember all of these guys' names. And
they were incredible.
Awesome.
And they had a band, Wayne and Norman, they had a band, and in Subspecies number 2, Denise Duff, I have to talk about Denise Duff for a second. She plays between number 1 and numbers 2 and 3 and 4, we lost an actress, Laura Tate, who played Michelle, the kind of love interest to Radu, or the obsessive love interest to Radu, lost her after number 1. Denise Duff came in and replaced her for that character in the other films, and she also brought an incredible kind of strength and beauty and kind of vampiric, a fledgling vampiric skill to the role. So between that, the cast, the locations, the cinematography, which I knew was going to be kind of European and not exactly American, the movies have a definite vibe to them that I think, you know, kind of makes them sort of hypnotic watching. And they, you know, there's a lot of people who love those films around the world.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. It's, you know, when you talk about the series and you're prepping number 5, so tell us a little bit about what's going on with number 5.
Okay. Numbers 1 through 4 basically kind of each sequel picked up where the last one left off. And so it kind of tells one long story of like the gradual changes in Radu as this person kind of like affects his emotions, and then her kind of gradual descent into becoming a vampire, even a reluctant vampire. And by the end of number 4, it seems like we sort of reached the end of that part of the story, and I'm not quite sure, you know, if we carried on from that moment, I think we'd start repeating ourselves. So for number 5, we went back in time, and I wanted to tell the story of how Radu became the character that he is and how he became a vampire, and the kind of history of the Bloodstone and the history of his obsession with this woman that looks like Michelle. So number 5 is basically kind of the 800 years in the life of Radu, you know, told in little chapters, kind of just showing us how he became the kind of obsessed creature that he is, the bitter monster that he is now. So hopefully we're going to go. Romania has now gotten to be too expensive for us to shoot there. So we've got some production partners who are taking us to Serbia, and because they have castles there and they have like early 20th century kind of neo-Gothic architecture in the cities. So hopefully we're going to get the same kind of production values of mountains and castles and ruins and Gothic buildings that we were able to achieve in Subspecies.
That sounds really, really good. I wish you luck on that. Now, do you have anything, you know, with the new Don't Let Her In, do you have anything sort of in the works you can't really talk about that maybe you'll be doing more for Full Moon?
We just finished this one, and I'm not sure. Charlie hasn't suggested that I do a sequel or prequel to this one, although I think he's waiting to see how the fans react. I know he loves the film, thinks it turned out really good, and So we'll see. I'm up. I wouldn't say no to anything at this moment, and I sort of have some ideas of what further kind of episodes I could tell in the story of these characters. So we'll see. I mean, the cast is really wonderful. This actress named Lauren Doctor plays Serena, the kind of mysterious artist who moves in. A guy named Cole Pendery plays the musician boyfriend, kind of a rascally bastard of a boyfriend. And Amber's played by Kelly Curran, who's like this really amazingly talented young actress. So the cast is really wonderful and, you know, helped me because basically with 6 days to shoot, I said to them when we first met, and here's the problem, you're casting in a pandemic, you don't get to sit in a casting session and meet people and get a sense of their kind of soul by talking to them. You're just watching audition videos. So you make your choices based on these audition videos and based on what you can kind of absorb of people's kind of sensibilities from their auditions. And then I had a phone conversation with all of them and we did a read through on Zoom. And I said to them, you know, we've got 6 days to shoot this. What I'm going to need from you is you come to the set prepared every day, know your lines, because then we can shoot faster and we can accomplish more if you're prepared. And they took that seriously and came to the set super prepared every day. So, you know, I have a lot to thank them for, too, that we were able to accomplish what we did.
Well, you know, they've always said that 90% of a good film is good casting. So.
Yeah, it's true, too. It really is true. Part of, you know, that's like, I wouldn't say it's 90% of my job, but it's definitely a huge percentage of my job is to have the right cast, because then the directing of the performances is really a matter of making small adjustments or, you know, approaching a scene in a slightly different way. But you're always surprised by what the actors are giving you on the set too. And Lauren, who played Serena, you know, just embraced that role completely and went to some very strange places for us. And Kelly, you know, is such a sweet, innocent looking person, but she ended up having to go to some really dark places too. And Cole kind of kept it all anchored in a reality because he had to react to a lot of strange things going on around him. So yeah, I mean, it was really interesting and it was painful, but fun, the experience of doing that movie that quickly.
Well, you know, I think it's great you were able to do that, you know, and during the pandemic and all that sort of thing that we've had to deal with, you know, being so sequestered and such that people are able to get through. And to be honest, it's the art that's gotten us through this part of the pandemic. It's the films. It's everything that we've seen on streaming and so on and so forth. So, you know, you've done a great job. Now, I do have another question. If people take a look at your filmography, you know, they'll notice a number of different films. I wanted to just touch on a couple of things I noticed. Mm-hmm. And you've done a couple of documentaries on films, and I noticed that you did the Scorsese Silence, the short documentary. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, somewhere around the year 2000 or something, as when Full Moon kind of went into hiatus for a while and things kind of came crashing down financially on being able to make the movies that we were making, I needed some other kind of work to do. So a friend of mine named Barbara Tonies had a company that was like a marketing company that did behind-the-scenes documentaries and marketing promo stuff mostly for Disney films. And so I came to work with her and kind of learned the process of doing documentaries, you know, because I'd been an editor in the past, and And so for me, editing and directing, it's all kind of part of the same craft, and it's all a challenge that kind of occupies your brain. So I went through a period of, you know, 15 or 20 years of doing like documentaries and marketing stuff, and got to work on a lot of really wonderful movies, including we did the Silence for Scorsese's DVD bonus feature. That's kind of what we were doing, bonus features. I got to do a really wonderful kind of feature-length documentary about the friendship of Walt Disney and Salvador Dali and their collaboration on a ill-fated kind of surrealist cartoon in the 40s. And so that was, you know, like to tell that story, which was like kind of not that well known, and people are kind of surprised because Disney and Dali seem like such, you know, opposite kind of people. But, you know, I told the documentary, I did the documentary, and then eventually got to curate an exhibition at the Walt Disney Family Museum and at the Dali Museum in St. Petersburg, Florida, you know, about that story too, you know. And so it was not as totally as much fun as making horror films or children's fantasy films, but it kind of, I survived on it, and I got to work on a lot of interesting things. So that was kind of my like detour for a few years. And in those years, I got to do a few movies here and there, and did a documentary for a yoga community in Northern California that has like little intentional spiritual communities around the world. Kind of spent a couple of years kind of hanging with them and kind of helping them tell their story, you know, like a self-portrait of a community and their devotion to the teachings of their guru. So that was another kind of, you know, weird little, my life is kind of full of these little weird side paths, which, but they all kind of involve making movies or, you know, editing movies.
Well, you know, I mean, that's what makes life interesting is all those little side trips. Trust me. Now, the other thing too, that I want to just get, since you started with editing, just tell us a little bit about how you got involved in film, and I mean, when I take a look at your editing credits, you know, you're doing Tourist Trap with Schmoller, Butcher Baker Nightmare Maker, which I friggin' just love. You know, The Dungeon Master, Trancers with Tim Tamerson. I mean, and of course, a lot of this was Full Moon, so and Empire. So tell us how you got started.
I went to the University of Texas in Austin, fully expecting that I was going to become a doctor, and, you know, started taking courses, got to be good friends with another kind of oddball hippie fellow named Daniel Pearl, who ended up being a director of photography of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre and a million music videos and commercials. He and I started hanging out together. And then one night, a friend and I dropped acid, and he took me to see a movie. And it was Ingmar Bergman's The Seventh Seal. And then the next week, we dropped acid again and went to see Fellini's Juliet of the Spirits. And those two
okay,
films,
and you're still alive after those two things? I'm impressed.
You know what? Those two films like convinced me that I didn't want to be a doctor. I wanted to write and make movies, and I was a musician too. So they kind of showed me that, you know, movies, you know, took advantage of everything: writing, music, acting, photography, all the things that I was sort of interested in as sidelines. So Daniel and I both kind of at the same time had that revelation, switched over to the film program at University of Texas, where there was money available at the time through educational TV at the time was providing money for little student shorts. So we were able to make movies, and there was a lot of equipment there at the school. So we got very good at making movies and editing in 16 millimeter. And then the opportunity to work on Texas Chainsaw Massacre came along. Daniel was the director of photography, and I got hired as the sound recordist, the location sound recordist. So there was like opportunities in Austin to make movies. But after a while, the tax breaks for movie investing kind of fell away, and there was nothing left in Austin but, you know, to work on public safety commercials and educational films. So a lot of my friends started leaving Austin and moving out to California, and all of them were working on a movie called Roar, which was a kind of a what the fuck kind of movie is that of Tippi Hedren and Noel Marshall and 100 lions and tigers untrained making a feature about a guy studying lions and tigers in Africa.
Okay, I have to come in here. When we had you on before, I was with Stephen Ronquillo, and we were talking about this, and then we were going through, like, and you mentioned Roar, and like both of us said, what? You were on Roar? I mean, seriously, that film, if no one has ever seen it, if not seen it, you got to see it and just, like, marvel that nobody friggin' died, though many people got hurt, including their daughter.
Got hurt. The Jan de Bont, who was the director of photography, who went on to do Twister and a bunch of other films as the director, got, you know, his scalp torn open. The safety measures were insane, and the temptation of lions and tigers not trained was crazy. But I started out there as an editor and worked on that film for, I don't know, 9 months or something like that, until Carol and David Schmoller got a deal with Charlie to produce Tourist Trap, and they hired me away to edit Tourist Trap, and that began my kind of association with Charlie Band, from Tourist Trap to kind of editing, doctoring a movie called The Daytime Ended, to doing Trancers that Charlie directed. And then I kind of went away and directed and edited for some other people for a while, and then Charlie kind of hired me back because he liked my work. So that was like a long kind of collaboration with Charlie in which we got to be friends, and then, you know, I finally got the opportunity to direct with a little bit of, what'd you call it? Is it Rage War? Is that the name of it now, or what's the...
The Dungeon Master, are you talking about?
Yeah, Dungeon Master. Yeah, one episode of Dungeon Master, and then which led to TerrorVision. And TerrorVision led to a couple of years of being in development hell, not finding the right script to do, and then eventually Subspecies. So, yeah, it was like, you know, from editing to directing, to me, is like a kind of a natural progression, because the editor really is the kind of next step in the writing of the story and the creation of the performances. So you learn a lot from being an editor, not only what shots you need to kind of tell the story, but how to put it all together and how flexible film is in the editing room.
Now, it's a fascinating thing to hear all this in terms of how it all works together. And the one thing about film, it has to be a crew, a bunch of people that have the same vision and work together in that. And of course, you went up the ranks. And so you know, got to give you credit, man. Absolutely.
Yeah,
no question
at all.
That's
how you learn. You have to pay your dues, and you have to learn the craft, and especially something like movie making that's kind of a composite of so many different crafts, from sound to photography to performances to lighting to just dealing with people and you know, the skill of being social and kind of keeping everybody on the same path, because not people come in, they don't really have the same vision of the movie. You have to convey that vision and be so prepared every day that people don't have the opportunity to kind of try to take over or impose too much of their own differing vision on it. So yeah, it's a really interesting craft, movie making.
So one final question I had, and before I do that, Rachel, do you have any questions or anything you want to say to Ted?
Well, I will say that I am not going to give you a number, but you are definitely in one of my top favorite directors so far.
One of the top 10 at least. Okay, thanks, Rachel.
No. I'm going to say top 5 definitely. Top 5.
Okay.
But I can't give you a number beyond that.
Yeah, no, you shouldn't,
yeah,
because
you've been
because every director is different, and everybody wants to be number one.
Exactly, and nobody is number one except for my lovey-dovey, who is currently editing together videos of his boss's son playing baseball.
Oh.
That's my favorite director.
Hey,
I'm sorry. So,
hi, Travis!
But other than that... Actually, he's playing video games right now. But, yes, it's been really fun. And I am actually really glad that Todd made me watch Terror Vision today, because I have, so many thoughts about that movie.
I don't know how you missed it growing up,
either.
Man. That's like every friend is supposed to turn their friends onto that film. That's how it goes.
Well,
slumber party. It's a slumber party movie.
Maybe it's because Terror Vision was released in 1986 and I was born in 1985.
Yeah, well, that could be, but it was released on Blu-ray like 7 or 8 years ago. So, yeah, your friends really are falling behind. You got to turn your
phone.
Well,
you know what? That's why she
here.
Hooked up with me, because I know the good
okay.
stuff.
Okay.
See,
you keep turning
and
on
and
stuff.
I know
yeah.
some of the good stuff too, but I'm. That's why I'm here. Is I'm the one that introduces my friends to all the weird shit now. And
okay, good.
Definitely going to be some watch parties or some Terror Vision in the future, because holy shit.
Yeah.
Or
it goes
maybe
down
I
well
say,
with
weed. Holy tomatoes!
Yeah, it goes down well with booze or weed, whatever you care for.
Hey, and both of those
yep.
things are legal in a lot of states now. So
yeah, that's
you
for sure.
Do you, man.
Yeah.
So one other question I had for you, Ted, is if you take a look at your filmography, is there a film that you feel has gone under the radar you need to let people know about that you're really proud of?
Let me think about that. You know, one film that I think was really maybe one of the best films that I got to do was a children's movie called Dragon World that came, you know, when Charlie started having some kids and decided he wanted to kind of branch out and started a Moonbeam label, which was like, you know, fantasy films for little kids. And so we did this movie called Dragon World that was for Paramount and was shot in the UK and a little bit in Romania when the weather kind of knocked us out of the water in England. But stars Andrew Keir, who's like a legendary kind of English actor.
He was Dr. Quatermass.
He was an amazing actor, a wonderful human being. And just getting to shoot in the UK was like this magical experience, and working with English actors was like a dream come true. And that movie is, you know, if you saw it at a certain age, it really stuck with you. But it was only available on VHS, and Paramount has it in their library, but, you know, isn't turning it into a DVD, and Charlie doesn't own it anymore. So that's one that, you know, you can see it on YouTube, there's a, you know, relatively decent version of it on YouTube. But for me, that was the, that's the movie that kind of got away. You know, Terrorvision, like, suffered in its initial release because it was sort of, critics did not get it at all. And only a few kind of hipstery kind of people, like, understood the humor of it and the kind of references that that it's filled with. And so it kind of got critically bashed when it first came out and didn't make any money. So that really hurt for a long time. And then, so it was like my little baby that got kind of bashed in the head. But over the years, it kind of built up this this following of kids that turned their friends onto it. And till today, where it's like, you know, like, really has, you know, infected a lot of people and a lot of young people, you know, in their 30s and stuff, you know, come to me and tell me how much they love that film. So that film used to be kind of the one that got away, but it's sort of come back. So now it's Dragon World.
Well, good. So tell us more about where you can see the films and Full Moon. Also, you know, your journal that you did for Subspecies, to talk about that and if that's available.
Yeah, so I did this journal. It kind of wrote every night in my hotel room after a crazy day's shooting. And just to kind of turn the horrible experiences of that first film into some kind of comedy for myself, you know, and also to just to get it down because, you know, my wife could not, there was no way you could express to any friends that weren't there kind of what you were going through. So I kept this journal. And then I sell it at conventions and at horror conventions. You know, if somebody tracks me down on Facebook, Ted Nicolau on Facebook, or Instagram, Ted Nicolau on Instagram, I can ship you out a copy for, you know, a little, not too much. If you like the Subspecies movies, it's pretty amazing kind of glimpse into the characters that were involved in the making of the film. The films themselves you can find on the Full Moon Features app, and a lot of them are on YouTube if you don't have the money. And if you don't have the money, you can also get a one-week subscription to Full Moon Features by getting their app. And in that week, you can just binge the hell out of a whole lot of films, my films, Stuart Gordon's films, Charlie Band's films. So that's kind of the story.
Oh, well, good. Well, Ted, we want to really thank you for coming on. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, sure thing, Carl. Thanks for spreading the word, man.
Oh, absolutely. And again, you got to say Don't Let Her In and where you can see it and all that. That's why you're here. So go
okay.
Promote.
Don't Let Her In. It's you can Google it. You will find it. You'll find the trailer for it. You can find it at, let me just sit down here at my computer and look at, you can find it on the Full Moon Streaming app. You can also find it, let's see here, Full Moon, Full Moon Features app, fullmoonfeatures.com is where you could find that app. Also on Amazon Prime Video. You can find it. You have to rent it. Roku, Amazon Fire TV, Google Play, and Xbox One on Prime Video. It's worth it. Prime Video, it's in 4K Ultra HD, so it's even cooler looking than what you'll find on the Full Moon Streaming app. So, yeah, check it out. Look at the trailer first. If it looks like something that you're interested in, check it out. It's a very kind of disreputable little thriller.
Well, that's the kind of thrillers I like, disreputable. Only directed by reputable people, though. So there you go.
Yeah.
Okay, so we're going to do a quick thing here called house cleaning. So this week we're sort of on a little bit of a hiatus. But on Saturday, we're going to be doing a commentary watch on my series of 70s hidden gems. And we're going to be doing The Little Girl Who Lives Down the Lane. which is one little perverted flick with Jodie Foster and Martin Sheen and Alexis Smith, Mort Schumann, and Scott Jacoby. So we'll be doing that. Now, you have something coming up next week, do you not, Rachel?
I do. On the 19th, we're thinking it's the 19th. I'm sure that's the date, which is a Wednesday. Am I correct? I don't have a calendar
right,
that, in here this year.
That's a week from tomorrow.
Yes. I will be having a couple of really prolific and wonderful animators, one of which who used to work for Hanna-Barbera and also came to animation fame by being the animator who was responsible for The Little Mermaid, Ariel, for Disney. Philo Barnhart and Charles Moisson are going to be joining us next week to talk about their lovely animation backgrounds and their upcoming cross-country touring schedule that they're doing. Yes, they're both vaccinated. They're awesome people like that. So they'll be joining us here soon. And I am also in the works on a very, very special piece to me that is going to be involving a lot of our local to me real-life superheroes. Yes, guys who go around dressed up as and patrolling the streets like superheroes. And I've got some really interesting talks in the work with those guys. So I'm really excited to announce that we should be able to be premiering that here soon.
Probably in May sometime, mid to late May would be my guess on that.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. We have a whole bunch more stuff that we've planned on and talked about. We just don't have all the details hammered out yet, but we've got some really good ideas for shows.
We've got Tony Burgess coming up. We've got a retrospective of Richard Rush with Gary Warner Kent, who was a stuntman on The Stuntman. Unfortunately, when I had that previously set up, Gary had to go into the hospital. But he is recovering now, and we'll probably have that by the end of this month. And we have also at the end of the month, we'll be having Joe Lansdale on talking about his new novel, Blood Moon, which is being released. So we've got a lot coming up. We've got a lot more commentary watches and that in the works. And we thank you all for listening in. And again, Ted, if you're still with us, thank you so much for being on. Really appreciate it, man.
Hey, man, thank you. Okay, I'll be talking to you.
Super serious.
Okay, I'll be talking to you, too. Listen,
okay.
Thank you very much, folks, for listening, and we'll see you next week on the ISF podcast. Good night, everyone.
Good night, everyone.
Okay, you guys.
Okay, take care, Fred.
Okay, you too. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye.